Our next presentation is entitled Our Behavior, the Pivotal DSM-IV-TR Diagnostic Error for the Paraphilias. Robert L. Hallon, Ph.D., has maintained a full-time private practice in forensic psychology based in San Luis Obispo since 1981. For 7 years before that, he had a private practice in the Los Angeles area and taught graduate school at the University of Southern California. Robert J. Thompson has been a trial attorney for the past 26 years. He lives and works in Eastern Washington and has his office in the Tri-Cities, Richland, Pasco, Kennewick area that surrounds the Columbia River. Please join me in welcoming Robert Hallon, Ph.D., and Robert Thompson, J.D.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's always kind of fun to show up on a Sunday morning and see who's still here. Actually, the number of folks here is it's nice, actually, when you're at the end of a conference to actually have people show up. Bob and I are going to talk about kind of an esoteric, jabberwocky type of world about sexual predators. What the heck is a sexual predator? Well, until 1990, there really wasn't such a thing. It certainly isn't a psychological term. It is a term that has been determined by state legislatures, and my state was the first after the Earl Shriver case, particularly terrible circumstance where children were killed after being sexually assaulted. As a result of that, the legislature and the community rose up in arms, created a statute to stop the abuse of sex offenses, primarily against children, but then that envelope opened up. All the laws, there's 18, 19 states in the United States that have sexually violent predator laws. Some states have considered them and passed on them. However, I think the trend is still going up as far as the motivations for having laws like this. There is no doubt that our communities have been very sensitized through media about the evils inherent in sex offenders, especially against children. As a result, there has been a move by state legislatures, politics, to do what's well. You know, when things aren't going well in your state, it's always kind of fun to put a particular class of individuals in their place to protect the community. That has clearly happened in the world of individuals who are involved with sex offenses. We have got into the idea of civil commitments. Yesterday, there was a question, I think, by Mr. Good. He talked about why these laws aren't unconstitutional. You use terms like double jeopardy, due process, equal protection. Understand those are terms that traditionally are applied to the criminal arena. This is a civil mental health law, and as a result, that's what makes these laws constitutional. I think there's one comment that came out of the decision in Kansas versus Hendricks, and then there's one Kansas versus Crane that pretty much set the parameters or the sideboards that we as attorneys work within and that we go out and we try to get assistance from mental health professionals to assist us, get a better understanding of what we're talking about. And I just want to read that so it puts to rest the understanding of why we're talking the difference between criminal and civil. Hendricks underscores the constitutional importance of distinguishing a dangerous sexual offender subject to civil commitment from other dangerous persons who are perhaps more properly dealt with exclusively through criminal proceedings. That distinction is necessarily lest civil commitment become a mechanism for retribution or general deterrence, functions properly those of the criminal law, not civil commitment. So the ultimate concept here is because you're the most dangerous SOB that ever walked the block and your preference is to offend sexually, that's not enough. That means you're a criminal offender. These laws are designed for somebody who has either a mental abnormality or a personality disorder that causes this individual to lose his emotional or volitional control. I know you guys measure that on a daily basis, emotional and volitional control. That causes them to be more likely than not to commit another crime of sexual violence. So that's the sideboards that we work within. These are concepts that candidly had really never been addressed in the psychological field. I mean, it's not to assume that there haven't been a lot of extensive writings in regards to sex offenses, deviant sexual behavior. Of course, that adds to the question, what is normal sexual behavior? But those are probably more esoteric questions that we can't handle in such a small group, because you don't cover all the various oddities that might be involved in what is abnormal or normal, candidly. So, here we go. There is a, as an attorney, we did not understand what was meant by this law. We had never heard the term mental abnormality other than the statutory definition. And so the role was attorneys got together, and I met Dr. Hallin, I think it was about 1998 in Chicago, first conference on sexual predators put on by what used to be members who practiced criminal defense. Now we became civil attorneys for the very first time. And through that concept, we had a chance to listen to the discussions about what is exactly a mental abnormality. Nobody really understood that, but what we found was that state experts always went to the DSM to find a diagnosis, to put their hat on. Now, understand that the introduction to the DSM says, you know, what you can't do here is use these diagnoses for a couple of things. You can't use them forensically to suggest that somebody created an act just simply because he has this diagnosis. And you can't say anything about how much this may influence somebody's ability to control their behavior. Those warnings are set forth in the DSM. That has never stopped the state from starting with that basic assumption that you've got to have this DSM diagnosis. In my state, mental abnormality or personality disorder are the mental health questions. And that raises some rather other interesting questions I don't think we're going to take the time to go into, but the idea of a personality disorder. If I look around the room, most of you got them. I'll tell you, 75, 80% of the people who are in a prison population have personality disorders. What does that mean? Remember, the whole concept of the law is, imagine a huge circle, people who commit sexual offense. That's criminal. We're looking for that small subset inside there that can't control their behavior. Now, I want you guys to think about, given all your training, personality disorders. How many people believe personality disorders control somebody's behavior, override their volitional control? Okay? There's a few people that do that. I just think that's all hogwash. Okay? So, anyway, and I'd be more than happy to try to educate you guys later on outside. Because I'm staying in that business. Now, I also want to tell you that there is politics and money. That's a great combination for how the world works. I grew up in a community, this Tri-City area, which actually has a nuclear plant. Hanford created plutonium for World War II, produced a lot of plutonium for the Cold War. We sit on the largest amount of nuclear waste, liquid form, highest Curie count in the world. Okay? I understand, because I was a politician at one point in my life. I was the mayor of my community. And so when you're out there and you're lobbying to get $2.5-3 billion for your community, and you scare the hell out of people because you're going to end up with large salmon and four-eyed salmon, well, we don't see that as a risk, but by God, it works on people who don't know any better. You can leverage a lot of money. In this particular case, nobody's really taken the time to, like, take a look at the state of California, how much money they spend on this law, versus, you know, traditionally we like to spend money and we like to have it make a difference, most of us. Some people like to spend money and feel good. But until you have all the dynamics, it's very difficult to figure out whether you're getting a bang for your buck. What I can tell you that sometimes I have concerns that the science suffers when politics and money get involved. As an example, there was, I think, Dr. Hallin brought up the point that during a deposition I took of an expert in the state of California, this individual had billed $480,000 in the first 6 months of 2007 doing these evaluations. It only took her 35% of her time because the rest of it she was an adjunct professor at a university. Not bad work if you can get it, I guess. So I think that there is that going on. But I want to leave you, before I give Bob the podium, because he's going to talk about perhaps our frustration going to court and getting banged around because we thought we knew what the science was, and having everybody say, you guys are out there on an island by yourself. Turns out maybe we weren't out on that island after all, but who knew until you actually went and kicked the tires a little bit. I'm going to leave you with this. Justice Kennedy in the Kansas versus Hendricks decision, it was a 5-4 decision that allowed this law to be constitutional, said that if we come to a conclusion or a point in time that the term mental abnormality is too diffuse or doesn't mean anything, we will revisit due process considerations. After we get done and Bob has a chance to kind of educate us, we'll find out whether or not we're starting to get closer to that or not. And again, there's a huge distinction between how the community views things and how they want to protect themselves versus what is constitutional. And sometimes I think that your science has been bastardized to get to the end result that everybody feels comfortable with. With that admonition, I'm going to give you Dr. Hallin.
To put your mind at ease, the first thing I want to say is I am not opposed to this law. I think it is a wonderful law. It should have been written 35 years ago or 50 years ago. Since this law has come into effect, the sex offense recidivism rate has dropped dramatically. Now, we don't know for sure if it's because of that, but it certainly is coincidental that when they started doing the research into risk assessment, sex offense recidivism was up in the 17.5-18% of men released from prison as sex offenders, they would recidivate. It is now down like 3.5, 5.5, something like that. Something's working. However, with that said, my sole purpose in being involved in these cases is two, I make a good living. And number two, I am attempting to defend our science. Nowhere else in my history, in all the time I've spent in forensic psychology, have I seen and listened to so much hogwash go down as expert testimony in courts of law. Now, my presentation today has to do with one of the reasons that has taken place. In 1993 or so, the task forces for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, which I'm going to assume everyone here knows about, the DSM, their task forces got together and they created some criteria and they kept some other criteria from the DSM-3R. Part of the criteria that they kept was for the paraphilias. And the paraphilias said something like, recurrent intense sexually arousing fantasies and urges over a 6-month period. At the same time, they removed from criterion B that the person has acted on the impulses. Now, a very interesting thing happened at that point, which will underscore the fact that most of our professional organizations are really governed by society and not by science or the profession. Some people from the Christian right started writing articles that the American Psychiatric Association had decided that pedophilia and molesting children was no longer a disorder. Well, they immediately went back to the drawing boards to try to correct that because they didn't want that kind of criticism, so they started futzing with the wording. Well, when they futzed with the wording, in criterion A, which is recurrent, intense, sexually arousing fantasies and urges, which is, by the way, the absolute rock-bottom fundamental diagnostic criteria for a paraphilia. If you don't have that, you don't have anything. They started fussing with that, and they took the behaviors where it had said in criterion B, if they have acted on the behavior, you could make the diagnosis, or if they were impaired by it, you could make the diagnosis. But remember, first, they had to find the recurrent, intense sexually arousing fantasies. You had to find the deviant sexual arousal. So in order to placate the Christian right, which I think is a wonderful scientific thing to do, they took our behaviors and threw it up at the very end of intense fantasies and urges, our behaviors. Nobody cared. And I'll tell you why nobody cared, because no one ever envisioned that a diagnostician that knew what they were doing would make a diagnosis of a mental disorder on the sole basis of a criminal history. But they did. And in fact, the Department of Mental Health in California quickly passed their own law in 1996. And they gave their so-called workshops. And in the workshop, which was actually an indoctrination, they told the state-appointed evaluators, of whom I was the very first one in the state of California appointed to that task, I did the first ones in December of 1995. They told us from the podium that we would have to diagnose paraphilia. Because paraphilia was probably the only diagnostic category in the DSM that could pass constitutional muster for making a person do a crime. Well, those of us that have been in the business more than 5 minutes know that's not possible. You don't do that. And so when I said to the speaker, would you please explain that? Do you mean that I'm required to give a diagnosis of paraphilia to these men? His response was a non sequitur, and in court it would have been objected to as non-responsive. He said, so now you're blaming the system? Yeah, I had the same reaction. I didn't know where that was coming from or what it meant, but I found out later because they bumped my butt off the panel as quickly as they could get back to the office and kept on the panel all those evaluators who were willing to leave their little offices and go into courtrooms and testify that they had formed psychological evaluations on these respondents, and on the basis that they had committed the crimes, went to prison, got out, did another one, and in some cases went back to prison and got out and did another one, on that basis alone, they qualified for a diagnosis of paraphilia. Now, how could they do that? How could anybody legitimately do that? Well, they waived the DSM-4, TR, and said, look here, criterion A, fantasies, urges, or behaviors. That's what it says. Well, Mr. Thompson and I finally figured out a way to get back to Columbia University and deal with the people who ran the DSM. So we got access to Dr. Michael First, who I had been communicating with for probably since 1999 or something like that, when I noticed some errors in some of the criteria in the DSM and had written to the APA about them. They put him on me because he's the editor of text and criteria for both versions, the DSM-4 and the DSM-4-TR. And Bob, being as persuasive as he is, Mr. Thompson, talked the judge in Washington into sending both of us back to Manhattan, to Columbia University, to interview and take the deposition of Dr. First. Well, from what Dr. First told us, this was the first time he had been informed that the DSM criteria was being used in that fashion, and he was appalled. So he immediately proceeded to dig up all the pamphlets. They keep excellent records. Every time they have a meeting, they record everything. And he found exactly the period within which the error took place. Okay, long story short, now what does that mean? Who cares? Who cares about putting these people away? I mean, they ask me that question on the stand all the time, and I tell them, frankly, I don't care what you do with these people. I really don't have any axe to grind whatever. And sometimes after court, I will tell them that if you leave it up to me, I know what I'll do. But that is not the point. That is not what we're in here for. We are professional psychologists. We are obliged, like the district attorney is obliged, first of all, to protect the Constitution. We are obliged to protect psychology. It is not being protected. Now, Dr. Good and Dr. Burstyn gave a great talk about the fairness of the law, and that is one element that's being worked on right now heavily. There are people that are still attempting to show that this is an unfair law. In my opinion, not going to get any place. First of all, there's too much social pressure. Second of all, the Supreme Court's already ruled. It said this is constitutional And this is where we come in. Provided you can show proof by the use of a psychiatrist or a psychologist with expertise that this respondent has the kind of mental disorder that we consider to pass constitutional muster, which is flatly one that makes the person do the crimes. So the error, the R behavior, has created a hornet's nest. Mr. Thompson has just prosecuted the first successful motion for retrials of a few of these men who were committed on the sole basis that they had committed crimes, because the R behaviors were cited as proof that they could make the diagnosis of paraphilia. Now, not only is that incorrect, but it's still removed from the statute definition of the mental disorder. No diagnostic criteria in the DSM, no disorder, no criteria of any single diagnostic category or any combination of diagnostic categories has the following two components as criteria to the diagnosis: predisposition to do any particular thing, and certainly not predisposition to commit sexually violent crimes, and two, volitional impairment in reference to attempting to control oneself from behaving in harmony with that predisposition. No DSM diagnosis does that. You can cite DSM diagnosis till you've used all the pages. You will never find it in there. If you look in the introduction, which I urge everybody that uses the DSM, what you do in your office for treatment, I don't really care, because nobody gets hung with your diagnosis. In the court of law, when you go to the court of law, a simple diagnosis that would mean nothing, absolutely nothing in your office except that you're trying to help a patient, will be used to hang somebody. They'll have the diagnostic category placed around their neck, the gavel will hit the podium, and that person's life is changed forever. And they have not a thing to say about it. I would urge all of you who may be just getting into this profession to take a great deal of time and study the fundamental differences between clinical and forensic psychology. They're two worlds, two different worlds. It's the lack of equivalence between the DSM diagnosis and the definition, the statutorily defined definition of the mental abnormality. In California, it's called the diagnosed mental disorder. It's that lack of equivalence that is both a problem and a benefit. I have repeatedly heard in the testimony of state-appointed experts that since the person has this particular paraphilia, remember, it's first made on the basis of the criminal history, therefore, voila, ipso facto, whatever other term you can use for automatic, that person fits the criteria for the statutorily defined disorder. Well, there are two real serious problems with that. One is an expert witness is not qualified to answer a legal question. And whether the person has a diagnosed mental disorder that's statutorily defined is decidedly a legal question. And the second question they can't answer is whether he's an SVP. Both of those questions fall within the purview of the trier of fact. But they utter them every day. Nobody seems to care. Let's say that you find that the person you're evaluating very definitely has a paraphilia. Well, you have to also find that it's a paraphilia that's similar to the kind of crimes he's committed, because they have to be linked. There has to be a causal relationship. The law requires a causal relationship, not just an association, a causal relationship between this mental condition, whatever it is, and these types of crimes. You have to find that proof of that. So after you find, let's say that you do legitimately find a paraphilia, and let's say it's a pedophile, a rampant pedophile, has 300 molestations before he's apprehended. You also now have to show that he also has some kind of psychiatric disorder that impairs his volition. Now, that's not easy. We're often challenged in court. Dr. Donaldson, who's here, is challenged far more than I am on this point. Well, Dr. Donaldson, I'll paraphrase it. According to your testimony, nobody could ever be found to be a sexually violent predator. Well, there may be a lot of truth to that, because what do you know? What do you know about volitional control? What does psychology know? Does anybody here want to risk the opportunity to give us a definition from psychology or psychiatry of what volition is? Right, exactly. It's philosophical, it's religious, it's legal, but it's not psychology, it's not psychiatry. Yet the Constitution, the Supreme Court rules, that without information from you, experts, they can't adjudicate these cases. So where do you go for that information? Where do you look to try to determine or estimate, I really should say, whether this particular respondent has that kind of volitional discontrol? First thing you have to do is define it. Well, you got to look for it. How do you operationally define it? And if you do, where is it located? Now, we have, those of us that have been in this business since it started, we know lots of things to look for, and I'm not going to take the time to teach you that. Someday, maybe, if you're interested, give me a call. But just want to let you know, it's not a simple fact of going to the DSM, finding a checklist that shows the kind of things that you could find in a criminal record, put them together, and voila, you've solved the case. Early on, for the last 10 years, we've been getting our asses kicked regularly in court. Because, first of all, if you were a juror and they found out what kind of case you were on, how would you like to go home after a nice long trial and say, yeah, we let this rampant sex offender loose today? Well, what the hell did you do that for? Well, you didn't have a mental disorder. Well, let's see, you might be looking for a new spouse. You will very probably be looking for a new job. So the social pressure is immense to disregard the science. But that's something we can't do. We cannot disregard it. If they want to fight it out in the trenches, if they want to bloody everybody in the arena, hey, let them have at it. But we have to be true to our science. If we don't have the information, paraphilia is not a default diagnosis. There are no default diagnoses. In the law, there is no default decision. You either have evidence or you have nothing. The problem with this error that it has created, first for the defense and now for the prosecution, is that it has allowed them to point to a pseudo-diagnostic method as if it were actually appropriate and possible to do, and in fact, encouraged by the American Psychiatric Association. Now, why have they not addressed this error? Why did they wait for Bob Thompson and I to go and approach Dr. First and sit down with him for 3 days to finally get to this? And still, the American Psychiatric Association per se has not issued any statement about that error. I don't know why. I know they've issued periodic red alerts. They did one in 204 and they did one in 205 for coding. Big red alert. Pull up the DSM website. You'll see a big red alert. Coding change for narcolepsy, coding change for sleep disorder. You don't see a big red alert about, hey, whoa, watch out here. This is a major error. We put our behaviors where it didn't belong. Our behaviors belongs is the second-tier diagnostic criterion. Okay? If you do not have evidence of the recurrent intense sexual arousal to the deviant pattern, you cannot make a diagnosis of paraphilia. That's impossible. The very word disorder tells you that. The very word that, the very idea that you could take observable behavior in that category, like a behavioral history, and transform that somehow into what's going on inside of a person is absurd. It's absurd. But we're doing the best we can to get this out. Dr. First and I authored a paper in which that is the subject and in which we offer our suggestions for how to make an appropriate diagnosis of paraphilia. We presented it at the American Academy of Psychiatry and Law in Miami Beach in October of last year. And now I'm doing the West Coast on this side to let you know about it. We have submitted it to the American Academy of Psychiatry and Law, and all of those of you who have published know what kind of process that is. It's one big pain and you know what. We have already written like four revisions, and we just sent back the fifth. I think there's some reluctance to publish it myself, but I don't hold me to that. I won't swear to that. Because if it is, that information has been successfully kept out of cases in both California and Washington on the basis that it was not peer-reviewed. Now, I have a simple question to ask anybody that says that. Would anybody point to who Dr. First and Dr. Alan Francis' peers are when it comes to the criteria in the DSM? I mean, who's going to peer-review them? They are the man. Dr. Alan Francis and Dr. First just wrote a very rapid editorial. And their reason for doing that was to try to get this information out as rapidly and as widely as possible because it is crucial information. So they wrote a very small editorial. It's like two pages in which they succinctly describe the error and the problems it has created. And let me just read the final paragraph. It's going to the American Journal of Psychiatry, if they ever publish it. But it's an editorial that was written for the purposes of preparing the DSM-5. They want to make sure the same error is not repeated in the DSM-5. And, in fact, want to try to get out notice as rapidly as possible about the error that exists. And this is the last paragraph. We greatly regret the confusion caused and have two recommendations based on this experience. They have talked about all the problems that have occurred because of that two simple little words. One, criterion A for the paraphilias should be restored to its DSM-3R wording, i.e., remove the phrase R behaviors in DSM-5. Parenthetically, if not sooner. And two, because of the potentially unforeseen consequences of rewording criteria, not to mention the disruptive nature of all changes, tinkering with criteria wording should be done only with great care and when the advantages clearly outweigh the risks. We don't know where this is headed. I've noticed that in the last 6 months or so, the district attorneys have softened their assault on me. I don't have quite so many scars on my backside as I had. I'd been getting early on. And I've even had a few of them say to me on the side, of course, they can't tell me in court, well, Dr. Hallett, it looks like you've been right all along. And Dr. Donaldson, he's saying the same thing. You guys know each other? Yes, we do. We're very good friends. I beg your pardon? Oh, it's called Issues for DSM-5, Unintended Consequences of Small Changes, The Case of the Paraphilias. One of the singular areas that Michael First and I disagreed on fundamentally, and we still disagree, he calls that minor word change. He's not a forensic psychiatrist. He hasn't been in the trench. if he thinks that or behaviors is a minor word change in that diagnostic category, he's learning differently. It's a profound, profound change. And with that, I'd like to open up the...
Just a couple quick caveats. Dr. First... Sure. Maybe this one's on. Dr. First and Dr. Hallin's papers have been in peer review for 6 months. I think it's starting to be a little bit lengthy. In earlier papers and in this field, there is so much pushback from the state, evaluators, from Attorney General's office and prosecutor's office. You can see a series of emails that go to these agencies saying, what the hell are you doing? A guy by Prentke, you guys may have heard of Prentke before, had the audacity of testifying for a defendant once. And the vitriol that was thrown at him by the state and other experts for having the audacity to talk about the science as opposed to the social value of putting bad, dangerous people away is pretty prevalent. What Bob just read you from Francis and First has not been published yet. Okay? I mean, even having an editorial comment go in creates, you know, everybody likes life to be simple and flow. Well, this is a big rock in a rather shallow pond, and it's no longer calm. So we're seeing a lot of pushback on these things. We are left in the situation, candidly, of do we start sending subpoena dicus tecums to these agencies and finding all those records, or will we try to let this process go on? I think Bob and I may actually disagree on that to an extent. So when we ask for the citation, they sent it to the journal. It has not been published yet. So I didn't want you to, you took the site down. It isn't in there yet. I just want to make sure you knew that.
What, one question. Who do you think between the two of us wants to go at him like a dog after a bone, and what, and the other one wants to just kind of wait a little while longer?
Bob, you're the more patient one.
I'm the more what?
Patient one.
Patientable?
More patient of the two of you.
Yes, that's correct. I want to let the process take its course, and he wants to go strangle a few jugular veins. So, please.
I learned last year, Bob, that you were doing this kind of work. I thought I was fighting this thing as part of a smaller group in Pennsylvania. I've been fighting the constitutionality of our statute, and I've testified in various counties about the ways, almost identical issues in Pennsylvania as you have here in California. And I was really pleased when I saw what kind of work you were doing, and seeing this little excerpt from your article just makes me feel really proud to have you guys as part of this organization. It's wonderful. But I want to give you an example of what happened in our efforts to fight the constitutionality of Pennsylvania statute. The state Supreme Court, in response to these issues about volition, the issues about the ambiguity of the word mental abnormality, they decided to send it back to the legislature, the Pennsylvania State Legislature, to have the statute's wording put into a form that would be less challengeable constitutionally. And whatever they did as far as that's concerned, I'm not sure. But one of the things the legislature did when they sent the statute back, and it's the statute from which we're operating now, is they made one tiny little change. And I'm providing this to you as an example of the damage that could be done by minor wording, okay? The original statute had a requirement that the relationship between the offender and the victim be initiated for the purpose of victimization, okay? The revised statute had a tiny little change. The new one said that the relationship was established in whole or in part for the purpose of victimization. Now think of the implications of in part.
That's the end of it.
If sex occurred, and by definition.
That's the end of it.
Stop.
Thank you.
When does DSM-5 come out? And is it going to have that excluded then?
Say that again, please, Dr. Prokobidge.
When does the DSM-5 come out, and are they going to take or behaviors out of there?
Well, it had been scheduled for 2011. They're working feverishly on it now, I understand. Dr. First is hardly in his office ever. He's out traveling all over the world. The DSM-5 is probably going to be almost a carbon copy of ICD-10 because when the DSM-3R came out, there was quite a few conflicts between the ICD-9 and the DSM. And in the DSM-4, they spent a lot of time with the people in Europe and around the world trying to get those two systems to be coherent and consistent. They did a pretty good job, but there's still some areas that they're working on. So hopefully, you know, I think the issue is going to be settled when the paper's published. I think it should be settled when the editorial is published. But those of you who have been in this work can appreciate the pressure against things like this being codified. There's a whole host of people that don't want this to happen. So hopefully by 2011 we'll have that. Any other questions or comments? Yes, please. Would you take the microphone?
You mentioned that one state panelist was, for a year, made somewhere around $450,000 doing these evals. I thought they were capped at $2,500 per evaluation.
$3,500 now?
$3,500, okay.
Well, do the math. How many cases would you have to do? $3,500 a case.
Do it with a lot.
It'll spend your time in your car and in prisons.
When you hit your word processor and change the language, or for the person alone, that's how you do it.
When you get this change, which I hope you do, what do you think the effect's going to be?
I didn't catch what you said.
I said, when you get this changed, which I hope you do, what do you think the ripple effect's going to be down the road?
Boy, that's a good question. For us, for the psychologist, For the psychologist, I think it's going to be both a boon and a bane. For defense experts, it's going to be a boon because they'll be able to practice their science and have it heard in courts of law. And for those who have not followed the science, they're in trouble.
I just have one question. The recidivism rate that's most commonly quoted for California is 70%.
70%?
70%.
Well, excuse me, let me interrupt you right there. Would you please cite the source of that?
Well, I've worked in prisons. That's just what I hear all the time.
I don't know.
I'm talking about the general prison recidivism rate. And what I was wondering is if you have any speculation as to why there would be a difference between the paraphilia recidivism rate as opposed to the general garden variety.
I don't think it's been established that there's a difference in recidivism rates between paraphilias and regular criminals. Ted, would you take the mic? This is Dr. Donaldson.
Of course, when you talk about recidivism, you have to be careful about what you're talking about. Recidivism requires two things. One is a measure of recidivism, rearrest, reconviction, or whatever, and on a time period. Now, most of our measures, that are the more reliable ones, are reconviction over 5, 10, 15 years. In California and in the U.S., the recidivism rates using that measure 20 years ago was up around 18% to 20%. For sex offense recidivism. Now, sex offenders also have a very high recidivism for non-sexual crimes, 50-60% sometimes. But the sex offense recidivism rate, at the time Static 99 was developed on their samples, which were samples from about the 80s, the recidivism rates over 5 years was 18%. At the current time, recidivism rates using the same measure of recidivism over 5 years are under 5%. So the recidivism rates have dropped a lot. And in terms of sexually violent predators, we think they're the creme de creme of the dangerous offenders, but Tascadero State Hospital has followed the records, which we had to subpoena. They wouldn't let them out. They followed 93 they were able to get all the records on, of those who had been found to meet the criteria for civil commitment by the state's evaluators, but the courts let them out. Either the jury found they let them out or there was a legal technicality. Of those 93, over 4.7 years, two rapists had reconvicted, two child molesters, and one exhibitionist. So we're talking 5-6% over 5 years for the most dangerous sexually violent predators. So, well, there were some who were reconvicted for other offenses, but those who had been reconvicted, of the 93, only five had been reconvicted for sex offenses.
Good morning. I'm Tom Hallworth from Philadelphia.
Hi.
Good morning. I just wanted to mention, you're talking about sexual recidivism, sex offense recidivism, and the kind of landmark study by Carl Hansen and a colleague, Bussier, who did a meta-analysis in 1998. That meta-analysis looked at, created a common metric and looked at about 28,000 or so sexual offenders across Canada, part of Great Britain, and then actually California, a large sample group of California. This was in preparation for the formation of Static 99. In that study with these 28,000, looking at them over an extended period of time, they found an average sex offense recidivism rate, recidivism being defined as reconviction, at about 14%. And that's kind of the preeminent study that everybody points to, particularly because it was became the basis for Static 99, and then a 2004 follow-up provides some good cross-validation for it. So,
thank you. Thank you for your input.
You know, and I guess the only other point I'd like to make about that, Hansen, when he wrote his paper in 2006, talks about recidivism rates, but the thing that we've left out is the impact of age on recidivism in general. Understand what happens in this arena. You commit a sex offense, and you do 15 to 20 years. You roll out when you're in your early 50s. Recidivism rates for people in their 50s, by Hansen's own work, maybe 6-7%. And so, in a way, the law, remember we talked about spending money and whether it made sense to spend that kind of money? When you're preventing, when people simply age out of these crimes, whether you're a sex offender or a general criminal, it doesn't really matter. The lines parallel each other. And so what I'm suggesting to you, when you look at the value of this law, we all feel good about taking the worst of the worst and putting them away so we're safe. But candidly, we're spending an awful lot of money and not preventing a lot of risk if you start looking at those recidivism rates. Again, when you're old, you just don't commit those kind of offenses. And that goes against, even with pedophiles, the rates follow the line of rapists. And that's very difficult for people to accept. Unfortunately, nobody likes to look at the science or the studies that are involved. So understand, when you spend a lot of money, maybe you're spending it on the wrong individuals, candidly. Maybe there's a better way. And candidly, there is a question out there whether or not this law has decreased sexual recidivism across the board. I think it's clearly a factor, but education has been a factor as well.
I would like to just mention one other thing about recidivism. I really don't care about it. That's not my bailiwick. And in point of fact, no psychologist should be even speaking to that. All of those instruments and things like that have nothing to do with a mental disorder making a person commit a crime. This statute is a dynamic statute. This statute says you must find proof that currently exists in this respondent, evidence that they have a sexual psychopathology that predisposes them to committing the offenses and volitional impairment in reference to doing it, some psychiatric psychopathology. Now, if you take the definition of the diagnosed mental disorder, dangerousness and its cause are inherent in the definition. So let me pose a question to you. If you evaluated a person and you found that they had a mental disorder that made them commit sexually violent predatory offenses, what else do you have to know? Is there any prediction necessary? The definition itself tells you that this person does that. So, but the risk assessment material that they give in courts, Criterion C it's called, is very good for the prosecution because it inflames the jurors even more. The experts get to say all these dastardly, negative, miserable things about this person. And by the time they get through, nobody up there cares whether he's got a mental disorder or not. They're going to give him one. Any more questions? Comments? Thank you very much for your attention.